Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
This past economic recession has been a difficult one. Not only has it been deep, with unemployment officially reaching above 10% at one point and many people dropping out of the labor market altogether, thereby masking the real human cost of our economic predicament, but it has been an unusually long one by recent historical standards. And as with every recession, criticism of private markets and capitalism becomes more pronounced. The Occupy Wall Street movement is perhaps the most visible manifestation of such criticism in the past year, but it should be noted that the skepticism of capitalism and economic freedom has deep roots both in the United States and abroad. Oftentimes, this skepticism can be found within religious communities. Indeed, Pope Pius IX, in his seminal encyclical Rerum Novarum, issued in 1891, set the table for the modern notion of corporatism, an economic philosophy that sees statist central planning as preferable to free markets and less government regulation. A little more than a half century after Rerum Novarum, scholars such as Gustavo Gutierrez and Leonardo Boff would further these critiques in a movement known as liberation theology. Even theologically conservative popes such as John Paul II and Benedict XVI have indicated their distrust of free market solutions to ameliorate poverty and bring about economic justice. These religious critiques of capitalism often refer back to the Sermon on the Mount, which encourages followers of Jesus to take care of the poor and weak in society. Many Christian scholars, such as liberation theologians of all denominational stripes, have taken this section of the Bible as a call for greater government interventionism. But can a moral, perhaps theologically oriented case be made for free markets and private entrepreneurship as a means of alleviating economic poverty and enhancing social justice? That would seem to be a difficult question given the emphasis on profit and self-interest within market economies. We will take up that challenge today with my very special guest, Reverend Robert Sirico, the co-founder and current president of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty, a pro-freedom think tank based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Reverend Sirico is a well-known commentator appearing frequently on all the major news networks and in print in places such as the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and First Things. He is author of numerous books, including his most recent work, Defending the Free Market, The Moral Case for a Free Economy, the topic of today's discussion. Please visit our website to find links to his books, the Acton Institute, and related podcast. And don't forget to add us as a friend on Facebook while you're there. We'll keep you up to date on all of our upcoming guests. Reverend Sirico, thanks for taking time to be on Research on Religion.
Really great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
One of the things I want to accomplish today is to review your personal history, which is very interesting and mirrors my own to some extent. Your intellectual journey, which you write about in your book, gives us some deep insights into your current philosophical and theological arguments for free markets. But before we even open the book, I have to ask you about the cover, because I'm the author of two books where I fortunately had a great deal of input on the cover design, so I'm oftentimes fascinated by how the cover of a book gets to look the way it does. Your book jacket not only includes the title of the book on a black background, but it has a picture of what appears to be a gold broken egg. Now, is that photo somehow symbolic, and did you have any input into that cover design?
Any input I had into that cover design was completely ignored.
Oh, my God. Well, what did you want on the cover?
What I wanted on the cover was the opening lines of the book, which describes the Korean Peninsula at night as seen from space.
Yes.
Which at the top of it is black, except for the capital city, Pyongyang. Mm-hmm. And then the southern part of the peninsula is illuminated. And I thought that was a wonderful contrast and a metaphor for freedom and economic control. I suppose that was too complex, so we were on a very tight deadline, because by the time I submitted that and tried to get that in the works. They had sent this back, and I just tinkered with it in the sense that they just had a nest with an egg in it, and I didn't care for that. Eventually, they had the broken egg, and what it's a symbol of, obviously, is something else I allude to in the book, and that is the old adage that you don't want to kill the goose that that lays the golden egg. So, I guess that's supposed to be the broken egg that the goose laid.
Well, it's in some ways reassuring to know that I did have so much input on my covers of my books, and somebody as famous as you still struggles with the publishers to get things done. So I don't know.
Titles of books. What the design of the front of the book looks like, all of that is really much in the hands. I mean, I have to say Regnery was very generous in having a discussion with me. We had a large set of discussions on the title of the book, and I didn't win on that either.
Oh, well, what was the title of the book that you were thinking
about? The End of Freedom.
The what was it?
The End of Freedom.
The End of Freedom.
The Moral Case for Free Economy.
Yeah.
It was a play on telos.
Yeah.
The proper end of freedom, or are we going to see the literal end of freedom? But they thought that didn't say directly enough what the book was about, and the salespeople said, you know, if we want to sell this book, if people are looking at it in the bookstore, this is what's going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So I made the introduction, The End of Freedom.
There we go. Yep, and that is how it does start out with that. And again, those free market marketeering people actually win out in the end, I guess.
They do, greedy capitalists. They are.
All right. Hey, before we get into the moral case for capitalism, let's dig into your history a bit. And
sure.
This is something that I often do with a lot of my guests. And I was really delighted to see you write about this in your book, Defending the Free Market, because it's my belief that intellectual ideas don't just emerge in a vacuum. They are often conditioned by one's upbringing. So you, I should note, have a very interesting past for somebody who currently runs a free market religious think tank. You were once a left-wing hippie who happened to share a smoke with...
I never said I was a hippie.
Well, it comes across that way. I mean,
no.
You did happen to share a smoke with Jane Fonda, who we all know is the star of the movie Barbarella. So tell us about your...
Everybody's jealous now.
I know, yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about your earlier life and explain how you came to be a free marketeer.
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and it was the New York of the 50s. A number of my friends had parents who had survived the Holocaust, and one day when I was watching the lady next door make some wonderful cookies, and she gave me some of them, I noticed that on her arm were some tattooed numbers, and I didn't understand what it was. When I asked my mother, she told me that that lady, Mrs. Schneider, who I call Mrs. Schneider in the book, and her husband came. They were refugees, and then I understood what a refugee was, somebody who came for help. I didn't know what that was. I was about 5 years old at the time, and my mother described it as compared it to catching a calf and tying it up and branding it. And she said that's what people did to Mr. and Mrs. Schneider and their family. And I was horrified, and it left, you know, an indelible mark in my own mind about how people ought not to be treated like animals. And so in growing up, when I saw beginnings of the civil rights movement in the South and other things happening, I saw these things through the lens of human dignity. I could not have described it for you that way at the time. You know, my mother certainly didn't describe it to me in philosophical terms. But now, as I look back, that's really what was happening. And so when we were a nominal Catholic family, and the Second Vatican Council had just begun, and there was a real secularism that invaded the Catholic Church to a certain extent at that time. And I, to make a long story short, abandoned the practice of my faith and looked at different religions, and eventually ended up in the early 1970s, so I'm by this time about 20 years old, on the left coast, and began becoming involved with left-wing politics, the end of the anti-war movement, the beginnings of the gay right movement, the farm workers' boycott of Gallo wine and grapes and lettuce, and the beginnings of the feminist movement. And that's the tail end of the anti-war movement is where I met Jane Fonda. In fact, I have a memory, though. I didn't say that explicitly in the book. I think it was the night Saigon fell. We were at KPFK Radio Los Angeles, which is a rather well-known Pacifica. It's part of the Pacifica network of kind of left-wing radio stations. Makes NPR look like the Bible Hour.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the kind of the beginning. And then what happened was I met a friend of a friend who I had an argument with, and then he gave me some books to read, and I made the mistake of reading them. And by the time I was about 26, I had abandoned the left. We can talk about the reasons for that. And then came back to my faith as a Catholic.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about that. You say you abandoned the left by reading some books. Now, what was the nature of these books, and why did this turn you? I mean, you're in your early 20s, and everybody in their early 20s understands the world perfectly at that time. So trying to get them to change their minds is oftentimes very difficult. So what's going on in your head?
Well, I was always open-minded. You know, I really thought I want the best argument, so I just thought, if I have the best argument, it'll show. And this guy gave me Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom and Bastiat's The Law, little book, Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman, and a host of other books. And I began reading them, and they were all, none of these were religious books, it's important to note. In fact, by this time I had become a nominal agnostic, and just really wasn't sure what the role of God was and how God played into reason and all those kinds of questions. And as I read these books, I understood something about the right to private property I had never grasped before, that the right to private property isn't fundamentally a right to a material object, but it's the right of a relationship between a human being and the natural world. Mm-hmm. The material world. And what we do is we draw from the material world its resources. We draw out of it the resources and place them at the service of human beings. That's another way of describing what the market process is, or at least the market process that I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
So that economic success is predicated on serving people. And as I came to understand that, I had to ask deeper questions about human nature itself. And those, I hadn't asked level questions at that level.
And that let me just pause you a minute. Is that what helps move you back to the Catholic Church and to your faith? Because, you know, I can imagine somebody handing somebody a book, F.A. Hayek, Road to Serfdom, or The Fatal Conceit, and somebody saying, oh my gosh, I got to go back to church. No, that really wouldn't happen. That's largely a secular economic book. But somehow during this period of time, you're also being drawn back to the Catholic Church. So what's the thought process there?
Well, the thought process was, well, who is man? You know, what are we made of? Why do human beings possess the right to property? What is it about human beings that constitutes this? And it was human transcendence, that we're not just physical, that there's something about the nature of the human person that transcends the physical. We see it in love. We see it in our appreciation for art. We see it in our creativity and our productivity. How do you make something more valuable? You know, you don't really change the substance of oil when you refine it into petroleum, but somehow you've added something, and by inventing the combustion engine, this becomes energy. It becomes something that's important for human well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was that, and then the recollection of what the sisters taught in school when I was a kid back in Brooklyn. Who is man? Why did God make us? The whole notion that human beings are created with an intentionality, with a purpose, with a sense of dignity, which I knew innately, but didn't know why. I don't think I could have described it, you know, intellectually.
Yeah, it probably harkens back to when you were that five-year-old boy and seeing your neighbor with the Holocaust branding on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I read other Protestant apologists, Francis Schaeffer and Walter Martin and others, But then when I began to get back into Aquinas and read his proofs for the existence of God, which are help, you know, and then met a fellow who was a philosophy for professor, Jesuit, and we had some conversations, and I just went to confession and began going back to the church. It required a kind of real social transformation too, lifestyle transformation. Even if I wasn't a hippie, I was certainly imbued with that that whole mentality in the 70s.
And how does this lead you to seminary? Because it's one thing to go back to your faith and start attending church again, but that next big step is, I think I'm going to enter the priesthood. That's a big step.
Well, yes, and the way I tell it in the book, perhaps even the way I'm speaking about it now, it sounds like it all happened over a weekend. And in point of fact, it happened over a several-year period. So I went from Los Angeles, took advantage of an opportunity to study abroad for a year in London. And coincidentally enough, this is right after I had come back to the church, and my spiritual director at the time suggested I read the Confessions of St. Augustine and the Apologia Pro Vita Sua by a now blessed John Henry Newman. And so I was reading that as I was going to England. Actually, I read Newman when I was in England at this college. And it happened to be a Catholic college campus of the University of London. And I just began going to daily mass and reading and talking with people about. And what was so nice there is they didn't know me from my old days. I could be a new person. And that's what happened. That year was very important and providential. I had no idea what a fundamental role it would play in my life.
Now, we had mentioned Jane Fonda as a person that you met earlier.
Yes.
But in your book, you also talk about other fellow intellectual travelers, and you refer to Ayn Rand.
I did not actually meet Ayn Rand.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask.
I read her books around this period of time.
And I have to ask, even though you didn't meet her.
I do write about her a little bit in the book.
Right. And so I kind of picked up the idea that you had met her, but this was one of those people, you know, the intellectuals on your bookshelf that you become, you know, closely associated with. You're going through not only this transformation, your economic thought at the time, but also your religious thinking. Ayn Rand definitely is a favorite of libertarians, but she is rather cold toward religion and spirituality. Did that pose a challenge to you?
It did. And she, you know, for a kid in his 20s, it was just exhilarating to read her. And there was enough of natural law thinking, enough of Aristotle and Aquinas in her, that it sounded familiar, and it was clear, you know, it didn't kind of mush around, especially when you compared it to Marcuse, who I had heard lecture at university, who was at that time a very fashionable New Left thinker, who I describe in the book as clear as linoleum.
Yes, yeah.
And she, so there was a lot, but her hostility toward religion, you know, it wasn't like, oh, well, we can think about this. No. It's that this is antithetical to the free society. This is antithetical to, you know, self-esteem. And so I had to grapple with the arguments that she put out in her book. And that took me, that was part of that 3 years of grappling with those kinds of things and reading other things. And I think Rand is, I described her in an article I wrote somewhere. The title of the article was "Who Really Is John Galt?" For your readers who may have read Atlas Shrugged or even seen this movie that was out, you know, she's always asking the question in the book, "Who is John Galt?" And I answer, John Galt is really Rand's substitute Christ. He's the perfect man who is the solution to the world's dilemma, who chooses his disciples and brings them away with him, and who is hated by the world because he is good and has these wounds inflicted upon his body. This is all a description of John Galt and his confrontation with the world that's in decline at the time in the novel. And it's so it's such a Christ metaphor that I say Ayn Rand was looking for Christ. You know, I don't mean by that objectivism is a form of Christianity. says, this is the one whom I've come to declare to you, who you have worshipped unknown.
Oh, a really interesting take on that. We'll link to that article for our listeners on our website, so visit that. Now, before we finish off with your history and getting to the founding of the Acton Institute, which I do want to talk about at the end of this interview, I want to dig it now into your defense of economic freedom, not only as a virtue to be valued in and of itself, because that case can be made, but also as a means of actually helping those who are not well off in society. And to do this, I want to jump ahead to chapter 5 of your book, which deals with what I see to be a very foundational issue that often comes up in these debates, and that is the inherent nature of man. Now, it is often argued by defenders of socialism or those in favor of more government intervention in the economy that man is inherently greedy and that we need a well-guided Leviathan, to use Thomas Hobbes' term borrowed from the Old Testament for a government, to ameliorate this tendency, to eliminate greed and possibly change human nature. Indeed, I would say that religious critics of capitalism, free markets, often point out that Jesus, as we noted in the Gospel of Matthew, needed to remind us to take care of the poor and the downtrodden, since humans don't naturally want to help one another. We do seem to have this self-interest or greedy tendency within that. This argument, I think, is in contrast with some of the more libertarian thinkers such as Ayn Rand, who argue that selfishness can be harnessed for the greater good, or the fictional character that you often refer to in your book, Gordon Gekko, from the movie Wall Street, who proclaim that greed, for lack of a better term, is good. Now, your chapter 5 makes a more nuanced argument, as you can see in the title, Why Greed is Not Good and Why You Can Get More of It with Socialism Than with Capitalism. Explain your position on the whole issue of greed, self-interest, selfishness.
Well, greed, the origin of the word greed is in the word desire. And in that sense, all humans are greedy. That is, we are born. It's one of the traits of the human characteristic, human character, to desire. What makes desire become greed is the disproportionate emphasis it places on self-satisfaction and the willingness to subordinate others to my satisfaction. This, of course, is unacceptable on a moral level. This is distinct from self-interest because, of course, we are interested in our own well-being, and that's innate, built into us. When Jesus says we should love our neighbor as ourself, he's showing that we are most familiar with ourselves, or often most generous with ourselves in the judgments we make of ourselves. But I'm not sure that I would agree when you say that human beings don't naturally look to the needs of others. I think we do. I think this is a trait that's also natural to us. It's called solidarity. We recognize ourselves and the vulnerability of other people. You know, we have sympathy pains for those we know, even those we don't know. If we're riding along a freeway and we see a car accident, we look. And why are we looking? I think it's more than just a morbid fascination. I think it's the kind of, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, kind of thing. And we do have, I think if you were to show a video clip of an execution to a group of people and watch their reaction to it, you would see them wincing. You would see them, you know, I'd be afraid of the person who wasn't wincing.
Yeah.
And so I think what needs to be brought to the table is a proper understanding of these two features, that we are individual, that we do have desires, that we do have a vested self-interest in our well-being, but that we also find ourselves related to people. And we need to make this work. How can we make this work? Why does it only result in kind of a notion of class warfare? Or, as you say, the Leviathan, you know, where everything in the state of nature, everything is bloody. And I think law, an understanding of ourselves, our proper grasp of anthropology, a proper sense of self-giving. This is one of the complaints I have about Rand when she speaks about the virtue of selfishness. I think she really is using the word selfish to mean self-interested. She uses that term too, rational self-interest. But I think she exaggerates the thing and makes it sound like any sacrifice we make for another person is a diminishment of our own dignity. And I think that's a very idiosyncratic use of the word selfish.
I think that you make a very good point on this. And as I set up the question for you, I set it up in very dichotomous terms, making it sound as if I did not believe that people had more altruistic motives. I actually do. And it's difficult to teach my political economy students that I do when I teach them about rational self-interest, because there's often that difficulty in conflating greed with self-interest and trying to disentangle these. You do this beautifully in your book. But I also think a lot of the critics of capitalism and of free market also believe that human beings don't have that altruistic nature in them, and that it needs to be coerced out of them. That, you know, we couldn't possibly help the poor through means of voluntarism. It because nobody would step up to the plate and help out. We would need to have the government do this.
We do it though. I mean, Historically, we see that we've done it, and this is the kind of the other side to the title, and why you get more greed under socialism or capitalism. When people are placed in a lifeboat situation, it becomes very ugly, where there's not enough stuff around, enough food, enough clothing, enough firing, you know, kindling for fire. People become quite ruthless, and that's what happens under socialism. When you look at the 70-year experiment in totalitarianism that was known as the Soviet Union, you see that kind of selfishness and real envy. You know, a lot of people talk about envy as though it just means liking what somebody else has. That's not what envy is. Envy is wanting what somebody else has at the expense of the other person. And you really see that kind of cultural formation that goes on in those societies, where people really become greedy because they're at their wits' end, they're desperate, and they become, you know, very hungry, as though they're never going to have another meal. So I think a society that has an abundance of wealth can have its moral problems. It can be tempting, it can lead us to superficiality and all the rest. Mm-hmm. But I think it can, I'd rather be in a situation where I had to deal with that moral dilemma than with the other moral dilemma.
You bring this up in your book as well, with a number of empirical cases, namely talking about a somewhat surprising one about the Pilgrims and John Winthrop, and that the Pilgrims, when they landed on Plymouth Rock and set up their living situation there, they originally dealt with a communal living situation. And a lot of people still today have this image that, well, if we just lived in a commune where we shared all our wealth, and that would bring out altruism. But it didn't quite work that way for the Pilgrims. And no. I want you to talk about that, as well as how some Christians, especially liberation theologians, oftentimes look back to the early church, and they look at Paul and the book of Acts, saying, wow, you know, those early Christians lived in communes where they shared their wealth. Why can't we get back to that? This is against that argument that you're making in your fifth chapter.
Yeah, well, with the Pilgrims, I mean, really, Thanksgiving started after the Pilgrim experiment in a socialist society, in effect. They had everybody growing things together, and they were going to share the produce evenly, and people just wouldn't take care of it. I mean, all they had to do was read St. Thomas Aquinas, and they would have seen the lesson that people always take care of what they own much better than they take care of what they don't own. And I don't remember that I put this in the book, but the one way I often explain it is, imagine what's the difference between the way you drive a rental car and the way you drive your own car?
Right, right.
If you go over the railroad tracks, you know, you tend in your own car to slow down. And that's because you're responsible for the springs in that car, and you're not in the rental car. And with the Pilgrims, they said, you know, let people have their own patch of property and see what they can do. And that's exactly what happened, and that's what produced the first Thanksgiving. With regard to the scriptures, it is true, the liberation theologians and other socialists have very often remarked on the early, what's called the early communism in the book of Acts. And in that regard, they're speaking of Acts chapter 2, where it says that the early church had all things common. And they see this as some kind of doctrinal edict that required that all Christians not claim any private property. But in point of fact, if you read the entire book of Acts and just go forward a few more chapters, you see that that's not the truth, that there's a difference between sharing one's wealth and having one's wealth expropriated from you. In the Acts of the Apostles, while this experiment was going on, there was a couple who had some property, Ananias and Sapphira were their names, and they went out, and it's very interesting. It says they went out and they purchased, they sold this parcel of property they had, and they brought part of the proceeds back to the apostles. And they lay it at the feet of the apostles. And here's what St. Peter says, and it's interesting, right from the mouth of Peter, he says, look, in this context, he's speaking to them. He said, when you had that property, was it not your own? And even after you sold it, were the proceeds, did they not was that not your own property? And now you've come here and you've lied to the Holy Spirit. And that was their problem. Not that they didn't own the property to do with it as they wanted, but that they were living falsely. So it's emphatically not the case that the church abolished private property. The church endorsed it, but the church calls us to be generous with it. And that kind of generosity cannot be legislated. It has to be formed in people. They have to come to a sense of themselves and the other that, you know, are animated by generosity. And that's what the church has done for 2,000 years. We invented the hospital. A colleague of yours there at Baylor wrote a marvelous book on the early origins of Christianity and then the victory of reason. Professor Stark.
Yep, Rodney Stark. We've had a couple interviews with him, and we'll have another one coming up shortly. So,
really ask him about this. You know, the whole way in which Christianity begins building institutions, and the hospital itself was one of those institutions. The university, the whole notion of institutionalized charity and internationalized charity is a Christian invention, and all of that comes out of a sense of moral formation. So I think the secularists who poo-poo that say, well, yes, that's nice, but it doesn't really build the kind of big things that people need. Well, it certainly does, and that's where you got the idea from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me press you on this a little bit. We talked about communal sharing amongst the pilgrims and the early church fathers. Let me take a little softer version of the critique of capitalism and saying, okay, some people should make profits, and I understand how that motivates people to work hard, just as the pilgrims found out that when they owned their own land or when they drove their own rental or did their own cars compared to the rental car, they took care of it better and were able to produce more. But isn't there at some point as a society we have to look at people and say, you know, you have too many profits? And this is a dialogue that is going on in our society today with Occupy Wall Street and a number of others. They're very much concerned about some of these large Wall Street CEOs having excessive profits. And you deal with this in Chapter 5. Tell us your argument there.
Well, what's a profit? You know, that's how I deal with it. I ask what the question is. A profit is the return on the service that you're giving people. Put very simply, when people purchase something and they exchange their money for the product or the service that you're offering, they're saying by that this service is more valuable to me than the money that I give you in exchange for it.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that Bill Gates does that, the more people give him money because they'd rather have the service. Why is what he obtains under those circumstances? I could see if you're saying he's selling things that are false or shoddy or not what they're advertised as being or done at the disadvantage of other people because he's had legislation created that prevents competition, all of those things. But under the circumstances of real free trade, why should, you know, he be penalized because he served more people? That just doesn't make any sense to me. The thing that people, and this in this whole area of the gap between the rich and the poor, the rich and the less rich, people seem to lose focus. They attack the gap. They attack the ceiling. But really, the real moral concern isn't the ceiling, for the reasons I've just said. It's just an indication he's serving more people. It's not even the gap, because nobody's really concerned about the fact that Bill Gates has X amount of dollars more than Warren Buffett. It's the floor. It's how are the poor doing? How are those who are the most vulnerable, how do they fare in a society? That should be the moral test of any economic system. And I think it is undeniable that in a market economy, that the poor fare better than their counterparts in any other circumstance, any other economic circumstance. Certainly that's true historically, and it's true internationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. And empirically, it's difficult to get my students to think about that, because we talk about, oh, we have, you know, poor here in society. And I say, well, compared to what? You know, take a look at the poor today as compared to the poor 50 years ago. The poor today are actually living at middle class standards, what it would have been 50 years ago. And that it's an important realization, because the poor are getting wealthier with the current system we have. If you look at it in a static sense and say, well, the poor are poor and they're always poor, we need to completely rearrange the system we have, we could actually be moving ourselves to a worse situation than what we have with what we have right now.
Yeah, and that's inevitably what happens when we see these kinds of experiments. I do agree that there's something unsatisfying about simply pointing out the fact that the poor in our country have 90-something percent of them have air conditioning, a similar amount have televisions or transport and things like that. Mm-hmm. There's something unsatisfying about that response, mm-hmm. because it doesn't get to the question that's deeper. And that's the whole point. The deeper answer is not a material answer. It's not just a matter of giving things to people. It's a matter of bonding with people, a matter of sharing a community with people, and you know, people having love, people having suffering with them. I mean, the family I grew up in, the household I grew up in, was poor. I didn't realize it at the time. We didn't own a house. We didn't own a car. We had six of us living in a relatively small two-bedroom apartment. My sister slept on the couch in the living room, and I slept as a child in my parents' bedroom on a crib, and then later a cot. And but we did not have this class consciousness of being poor. And my neighbors were like that, in a similar situation. Today it's very different, and I think that a lot of the ideology that encourages envy or a false notion of rights, that I have the right to the lifestyle everybody else has without necessarily working for it or having the opportunity to work for it, is those are some of the deeper questions.
Mm-hmm. Let's explore that a little bit more and think about ways that we could possibly encourage greater bonding, as you call it, or greater social interconnectedness, perhaps even Christian charity in society. What kind of solutions would you propose to not only dealing with the material causes of poverty, but the other social issues or spiritual issues as well?
Well, if I were to point to one big thing, I would say that over the last 50 years or so, that many of our institutions that were moral-forming institutions, I'm thinking of things like orphanages and schools and various other kinds of social service agencies that serve the poor, that these have been subsidized and eventually controlled by well-meaning bureaucrats and politicians. Now, of course, the politicians do this in large part because they know there are constituencies who want them to make, you know, funding available for various projects, and so they get votes by doing that. So this is what kind of gunks up the whole works here. But with all that good intention, what ends up happening is that these institutions become more and more distant from the people they're serving. And that means that these schools, these agencies become more secularized. And people themselves, who would be called upon by their churches or extended communities to something on behalf of people in their neighborhoods now feel that the state's doing it. Mm-hmm. Why do I need to help this young girl who's pregnant outside of marriage because the state's going to give her birth control, it's going to pay for the abortion of her baby, or it's going to put her up in an apartment and give her food stamps and give her, you know, educational support and all these other things. Meanwhile, we have this burgeoning crisis of out-of-wedlock births among precisely those kinds of people. In fact, you look at the most marginalized and eviscerated communities, the American Indians, the African Americans, and these girls that I'm talking about. These are among the most subsidized groupings in this country, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And what I'm suggesting is that we find a different way to do this. And part of that is by allowing charities to have the resources. By that I mean let people donate to them from their tax liabilities so that you have a form of subsidiarity going on at the most local level of need. Subsidiarity meaning that we have institutions that deal with people that are proximate to the problem. Not distant, not in Washington, not animated by politics, but by what they see directly in front of them, and allow them to creatively, innovatively, and very diversely take care of the needs that they confront. And this means a reduction, simultaneous reduction, in the amount of government programs that go toward this, and a simultaneous increase in the amount of local charitable endeavors. And everybody then becomes a philanthropist under the system because part of your tax dollars and my tax dollars we can direct to agencies that we're convinced serve the poor.
Now, you brought up the issue of subsidiarity. We talked with Philip Munoz a few weeks back about this in light of the healthcare initiative, and I want to come back to that issue as well. But I just want to take a sidestep here and get your opinion on a bit of a public policy issue, that one that I've been wrestling with, and I debate one of my colleagues, Jay Hine, with many times. We had a podcast about this, and this deals with the issue of George W. Bush's faith-based initiative, which had its roots back in the Clinton administration under something known as charitable choice.
Right.
And we're talking here about trying to encourage voluntarism, charitable activity. And what the faith-based initiative does was, one, it leveled the playing field between secular and religious institutions. And I found that to be rather encouraging. But the thing that troubled me was that it then set up a system wherein religious charities could compete for government funds, just as academics write for grants. Now charitable institutions could write for grants saying we want to set up a hospice or a soup kitchen or a clothing drive or something of that nature to help out people. I was always concerned about that because, as you mentioned, this issue of subsidiarity, that religious charities prior to competing for government funds would always have to go to their constituents, their parishioners, their
right.
flock, to make a strong case of this is why we're doing this and this is why you, as a member in the pews, should be concerned about this. But
right.
with the faith-based initiative, it all of a sudden your attention turns to Washington, D.C. and what they want. What are your thoughts on the faith-based initiative?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was quite involved with all of that. I was one of the probably 30 or so religious leaders who were asked by the then President-elect George Bush to meet in Austin, because he hadn't gone to the White House yet, still President-elect. It was the day, I remember, it was the day that he announced Colin Powell's appointment as Secretary of Defense, because he was going from our meeting to public meeting and a press conference. And I was on that very early on. I became part of a working group that met with the White House on a weekly conference call. And I saw the whole thing go from Marvin Alasky's idea of compassionate conservatism to this basically political operation that would seek out inner city pastors and offer them grants. We had people from our office who went to a number of these programs to see what they were doing, and it was all about how to apply for government funds. I think it was a colossal failure. I warned about it in those private meetings. I said it to the president to his face. And I wrote about it, including in the New York Times, when DiIulio, who was the first director of that office, was resigning. And I tried to make the case that a better thing than this kind of direct government aid was to have these kind of tax credits, not tax deductions, but tax credits that allow corporations and individuals to pay a portion of their tax liability to charities, thereby fulfilling their social commitment. But I know strict libertarians wouldn't like that very much, but the bureaucrats didn't like that very much, and even the left on charitable organizations didn't like it because it just didn't give them enough control of the whole thing. But in any event, it was ignored by the advisors at the White House because I suspect they felt it was a good opportunity to connect with the inner city and to kind of win votes in their direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see how your approach with the tax credits would still make the various religious charities compete for the interest of the general public, the individual, which keeps them engaged in the charitable giving as well, and not just government bureaucrats. And that's I like that idea. Let me go ahead and switch gears a little bit, or at least bring it back to what we were talking about, the issue of subsidiarity. And as I mentioned before, we had a discussion with Notre Dame professor Philip Munoz a few weeks back regarding the healthcare mandate, which has generated a lot of controversy in Catholic circles recently, as well as amongst other religious denominations as well.
Sure has.
The U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference recently released a statement that was very critical of a certain component of what is known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. It required all insurers to cover contraception, sterilization, and abortive fascient drugs for their employees, irrespective of whether they held moral objections to these products or these procedures. What was interesting to me in watching this recent debate was how the Catholic bishops were generally in favor of national health care until this regulation hit them directly. Now, we could discuss the particulars of this case, but I want to get your views on a broader issue. Why do you think it is that the hierarchy of the Catholic Church tends to favor more intrusive government intervention into the economy? And do you think this healthcare mandate that they don't particularly like might have an effect on shifting their thinking away from a more corporatist philosophy toward a more let's rely on subsidiarity?
Well, if I were going to make the case on behalf of the bishops, here's what they would say. They would say, look, we have had roughly 40-year run of accepting various forms of subsidy to Catholic charities, to Catholic relief services, hospitals, and taking on partnerships with the government, such as adoption programs and placement of young people in foster care homes. And they'd say up until now, there have been several precedents where our religious liberty was protected. This is unprecedented, and they are right in this regard, that the government wants to take this back now. My warning wasn't that you couldn't get away with it for a while. It's that, and I wrote this in probably the middle 90s when the first debate on welfare was coming up, and I zeroed in on Catholic Charities USA and an article in the Wall Street Journal entitled Charities on the Dole. And what I tried to point out there was that we become dependent upon them, and we begin to think like the government. And this thinking like the government is what gets us in trouble because the water heats up very slowly and we don't realize that we've lost our identity. Now, not only in this case of the mandate, but also in the loss of several institutions already. I'm thinking of a foster care agency and the Catholic Charities in Illinois that basically just switched its sign. Just said we're not Catholic anymore. We're now this kind of more religious but secular thing that we can provide foster care services because the government was requiring the agency to place them at home. using that as an indication, the other attacks on other, there was a Lutheran school. The Supreme Court upheld the Lutheran right, but there was a Lutheran school that was being told that they couldn't fire a teacher because a teacher was just a teacher, not a minister, but they fought that one.
Yeah, it was the famous Hosanna Tabor court case that came out about a year ago, yeah.
Good. And now with this healthcare thing, I think it is getting the bishops to think about this, but they're in the middle of this battle right now. So a good number of them still believe in universal health care as defined by the Affordable Patient Care Act and simply want this exemption for their institutions broadly understood. So it's not just those within our own congregations, Catholics serving Catholics, but more broadly where we're hiring and serving non-Catholics to be understood there, and that's the point of the contention. I hope they can see that this is a logical trajectory and that maybe you can push this out for another two or three administrations, but at some point, if the society continues in the way it's going, where we're becoming more and more secularized, these are clashes about what we consider marriage to be, clashes about when we believe life to begin, clashes about what the procreative function in the conjugal act should be like, and what can control that. Remember that our insurance companies are not just separate entities. Very often the church is its own insurance company. It's self-insured. And so they're going to come in and tell us how to provide services and what services we can provide. And my hope is that they'll see the connection between these things, because as I quote in the book, he who drinks the king's wine will sing the king's song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's this idea that as you can hope for a bigger and bigger government with the exemptions that you prefer, but as the government gets bigger and bigger, those exemptions become more and more difficult to secure over time.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to finish off with the time that we have here. Talking about your institute, the Acton Institute, and we haven't covered everything in your book, Defending the Free Market, and I'm going to.
There would be no reason for anybody to buy it.
I know, that's why I'm saying I'm going to leave it there, because there are a few instances in there which brought me to some insights that were I had never had before, and I've dealt with a lot of this free market stuff before. So I encourage folks to pick up Defending the Free Market, but I do want to talk about your institute, the Acton Institute.
Yes.
For those of you who don't know what it's about, could you fill them in on who was this guy named Lord Acton, and what do you guys do at the Acton Institute?
Well, everybody knows who Lord Acton was. They may not know who he was.
Oh, okay.
Connected to him, but they kind of know. They know a quote from him. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
I got to stop you. That's interesting, because I've always attributed that to Edmund Burke.
No.
Okay.
Absolutely, Acton.
All right.
And its power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. People say power corrupts, and you know, but I quoted it correctly there, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a historian. He was a man who was born in Naples, but was an English citizen. He spoke all of the languages on the continent. He was a wonderful reader, and had one of the largest private libraries in the Victorian era, which is at Cambridge University now. And his concern was about the role of religion and freedom. And so these were the two themes that he kept going back to, the importance of the one and the other. And we named the Institute after him, not because we follow his teachings as a kind of magisterium, but because we think that the thrust of his ideas and his work were such that it could guide us in a general sense. And our institute was founded in 1990 with an aim at helping religious leaders think through the moral potential of a market economy, helping business leaders see their moral vocation, not just seeing their work as kind of utilitarian function, but as really something that they're called by God to do. And we have a whole host of programs, conferences. We have a big thing we call the university, which is a one-week thing here in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that offers 90-something courses with 700 or 800 students who will come from all over the world. We have a whole set of very sophisticated high-tech video production, documentaries, and curriculum that can be used in churches and Sunday school classrooms and the like. All of this trying to make the case that we need to bring together common sense and economics.
I have to ask you, because I'm a nuts and bolts kind of guy and I like to figure out how things work on a day-to-day basis. When you set this up back in 1990, you were an ordained priest then.
Yes.
And so did folks, your colleagues at seminary, friends that you had known, or people from around parishes that you were hanging out in, look at you and say, Robert, what are you doing? This is kind of a crazy thing to do.
Yeah, I kind of... I knew when I started it that I would have kissed my career goodbye if I had any ecclesial ambitions. And thankfully, I didn't. I was older when I went into seminary, and you know that just wasn't what I was looking for. But yeah, I mean, a number of people, and I've gotten you know, over the years, all kinds of as you can imagine, letters and stuff. But it really was on the. It was an idea whose time had come, and then the Soviet Union fell that next year.
Right.
And the Pope came out with this incredible encyclical called Centesimus Annus, and I got to meet that Pope, and I got to meet this Pope, and be involved in a variety of things, both in the Catholic Church and elsewhere. So it's turned out very well, but it was, you know, it did take a little bit of thick-headedness and a thick hide to go ahead with it and know that, you know, sometimes you don't make a lot of friends, but you can make a lot of other friends.
Mm, that's true. The other thing I have to ask, too, is do you still, as a priest, have other ecclesial responsibilities?
I always have. I always have. From the beginning of the Acton Institute to this day, I've been involved in pastoral work. And right now, I was a pastor for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
But now, right now, since a few months ago, I'm on the staff of a parish here in Grand Rapids. And for instance, this morning I said Mass before I came into the Acton office.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, in between calls, called somebody who's just diagnosed with a brain tumor. I'll go to the hospital. I'll anoint the sick. I hear confessions on a regular basis. I'm just a real working priest.
Yeah, and a real busy guy as well. One of the other things that
the
I noticed...
The advantage of celibacy.
There you go. One of the things I noticed on your biography, too, that Acton did is that you run an AIDS initiative. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, no. We don't run an AIDS initiative.
Okay.
I think what you're referring to is in my bibliography that among the things I have done was a chaplain to AIDS patients
okay.
at the National Institutes of Health. That was some years ago.
I see.
Final production of AZT, I was working with a number of people dying from AIDS. They knew very little about it then. Many of them dying from some experimental drugs they were trying. So just that was part of my pastoral ministry, and I haven't done that for a while because that's really largely under control now. But at that time, you know, when I was in seminary and when I was ordained, that was a major, anybody with an AIDS diagnosis was diagnosed as dying.
Yeah. The reason I bring that up and the reason I do want to highlight this is because, again, when you take on a defense of capitalism and a free market perspective, a lot of people think that you lose your caring or concern or compassion for others. But your own work, your own life, and your book really reflects that. That is not the case, that a great deal of compassion and voluntarism and that spiritual side of you can come out and actually flourish in that kind of free market or a free world. So,
yeah, I mean, those are things, I mean, that go deeper than the economic questions. I think the economic questions are very important, but, you know, one's concern for the poor, I haven't turned over my commitment to the poor over to bureaucrats, let's put it that way.
Okay. Well, how can more people like me, who's a professor who loves religion and liberty and has written on it, or just general folks get involved with the Acton Institute? What would you recommend for them?
Well, I'd suggest you go to our website, acton.org, acton.org, and be sure and look at all of the different tabs, because we have research, for instance, if it's professors who are writing or reviewing. We have an academic journal, a refereed academic journal called the Journal of Markets and Morality. If you're a student and you're into these ideas, whether from a Catholic or a Protestant perspective, you can look and see the various things that we have going on the church's social teaching, on Kuiper and the translation project we have dealing with some of the writings of Abraham Kuiper, a famed Calvinist writer. We have a whole bunch of programs, including the Acton University, which is good for just regular folks who are interested in these ideas. It's an exciting week-long experiment with ideas and people. Our website is translated into, I'm just counting them now, 7 languages.
Wow.
And also be sure to look at Acton Media, because we have a whole wonderful video archive and curricula that would be of interest. We have a blog if you're a blogger, and of course we always need people's financial support.
Mm-hmm. Well, that are a number of great ways to get involved, and I want to thank you, Reverend Sirico, for being on Research on Religion with us.
Really great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.